Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Project Zion podcast. This is Brittany Mangelson, and I'm going to be your host for today. And I am super excited about this interview. We have got on Gina Colvin, who is no stranger to Project Zion podcast or the podcasting world in general. Gina is the host of A Thoughtful Faith, and she has interviewed people from all over the spectrum of the restoration, both in the larger Mormon tradition to Community of Christ and everywhere in between. So we have had Gina on the podcast before. She was part of our Fair Trade series, which is all about faith transitions. We did a podcast episode with her when she, right after she was confirmed in Community of Christ at World Conference in 2019. So this is just going to be a catch-up episode as Fair Trade Chapter 2. Since then, she's been ordained. She's been involved in a lot of things, and I'm just excited to chat with her. So Gina, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, kia ora, Brittany. It's a thrill to be here with you.
Yes, like I said, I'm so excited. So let's just, I guess, pick up right where we left off. Listeners, if you haven't listened to Gina's first episode, I will be sure to link that in the show notes because it talks about her Mormon upbringing and background and her faith transition and how she found Community of Christ and how she decided to become a member in New Zealand when there isn't really a presence in New Zealand. So it's a really fascinating story. So be sure to check that out first. But Gina, I guess, do you want to just give us a brief overview of who you are in case there are some people that have not listened to that first episode?
Oh, sure, Brittany. Thanks for the lovely introduction. I think, you know, as a Maori woman, and that means I'm my father and his father's, etc. His parentage is an Indigenous New Zealander. So, like, in my custom, I would say, ko hiku rangi te maunga, ko waiapu te awa, ko ngāti pirau te iwi, which is to say that my mountain is hikurangi and my river is waiapu, and my people are the people of Porourangi. And so that is my foundational identity. But here I live in Christchurch, New Zealand, which is in the South Island. Nathan and I are the parents of six boys. One of us who came to us biologically and the others who came to us by other means, not theft, by the way. and, you know, like really thrilled to be part of this conversation. I was talking to my niece yesterday who's like considering her spiritual formation, a really similarly sensitive spiritual young woman. And we were talking about churches and she didn't grow up Mormon. But it's just such a thrill to be at this time of my life in which matters of spirit and church and faith are of a primary professional but also personal interest and importance.
Yeah, and the depth of knowledge and experience that you have and the cultural comparison to my very white Utah way of work, looking at the world is always so refreshing. So yeah, I'm really excited to have this conversation. So let's just pick up where we left off. World Conference 2019, you were confirmed at the beginning of World Conference. And I know on your previous episode, you shared your thoughts on World Conference and but what has life been like since? Clearly, we are in the midst of a global pandemic, but also New Zealand has been totally rocking the response.
Nice.
But yeah, what kind of things have been happening in the life of Gina Colvin?
Religiously?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think with everybody, it's on a go slow. The frenetic activity of church attendance has been for everybody, including New Zealand, has been wound down considerably. And I think that's actually really good to have a pause and to notice the hustle and bustle of church activity, which is sometimes our religious formation sometimes isn't the same as our spiritual formation. So this has been a really good time just to take stock, I think. I see a lot of people using this time wisely to consider what's useful and what's not useful. and to settle into a quieter spiritual rhythm. So that I've really been enjoying that. In terms of church activity here in New Zealand, you're right to say, Brittany, there's not much of a presence of Community of Christ, and that's historical in many respects. Community of Christ never really had an evangelizing mission here in New Zealand, and the Mormons beat them to it. But in many respects, I think Community of Christ is much more better fit culturally. We're very liberal and somewhat a little bit secular, but we're very politically liberal, social democratic. And I look at Christianity broadly in New Zealand and I think, man, Community of Christ is so intuitive. And would intuitive in respect to New Zealand culture. It just sort of picks up the things that we could socially and culturally are really important to us. And it beautifully fits into a Māori worldview, which is really important to me. So I've been quite excited and have been in discussions with Mariva, and who is the apostle for the Pacific region, about what that looks like for New Zealanders and what Community of Christ looks like for particularly Pacific Islanders and Māori. And can we find an expression of Community of Christ for this country? What movements do we need to make theologically to make space for, particularly for Indigenous Pacifica Polynesian people who aren't desert people? You know, we're not desert Hebrew people. We're seafarers and pathfinders and wayfinders. And the ocean is important to us. So this is a lovely movement to make, to say what is an ocean? What is God? What does Jesus mean? What does spirit mean to an ocean people? So there are a lot of rich conversations to be had in that space. And I'm looking forward to carrying those on with Ralph Aona, who is the Hawaiian mission center president based in on Oahu. So it's exciting, theologically, really, really exciting. As a contextual theologian, this really kind of greases my wheels.
Well, and how refreshing to not have Christianity through Community of Christ be this thing that we have placed on your culture, that we have placed in your borders, that we have placed in your waters, that we have shoved down your throat in very violent ways, right? Like that's the history of how Christianity has spread. But to have this movement, these conversations started by an Indigenous woman, just feels like the ultimate restoration in a way. Like it just feels really, really beautiful.
It is. It's really exciting. And it's quite nice that Community of Christ really hasn't taken hold here in New Zealand. I mean, we do have a few members, particularly in Auckland, but it's just really fresh territory. Like it can start decolonized. Yeah. We don't have to decolonize it on the ground and do all the hard work. Like, I mean, I'm not sure that it's going to take off as a movement, but it's really wonderful for me to be part of a broader conversation of Māori theologians in New Zealand. And then I can hold my head up high as a member of Community of Christ and say, actually, we're really at this fruitful period of time in which other churches like the Anglican Church, the Presbyterian Church, are grappling with histories, colonized theological histories, church histories, that they have to deconstruct and reconstruct. You know, I have the pleasure and the advantage of being part of an established church community, which is open to having those broader conversations, so that if we do enter here and any great presence is a Māori presence, some of the groundwork's already been done, the consultation's already been done, the theology's been set down, and this place has been acknowledged as having its own history and context. So that's quite gorgeous. I really enjoy that.
And I, as you were just speaking, I could not help but think of how, you know, you were once a Mormon woman who wasn't even allowed to plan a worship service, or probably wasn't even allowed to be in the building without the presence of a man. Yeah. And so it's not even a full circle moment. It's like a completely different I don't even have the words for it. It's just, it's a completely different universe that you're now living in, being a foundational member of not even knowing what this is going to look like, but a movement, a spiritual revolution that incorporates your culture in a way that Mormonism was one of those religions that came in. And, you know, yes, New Zealand Mormonism probably looks very different from Salt Lake Mormonism, but Salt Lake Mormonism is still doing everything they can to control New Zealand Mormonism, right?
Right. Yeah. It's a lot of replication. It's a lot of imitation going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just the fact that this is being led by a former Mormon woman just makes me really excited.
Well, you know, I'm excited too, because it does seem that former Mormon woman, like, do the stuff, right?
Yeah.
I'm talking about Jacinda Ardern as our prime minister.
Yes, exactly. Oh, exactly.
No, I mean, I think that says something about the tradition. I was reflecting on it and I thought, you know, I don't regret ever being Mormon. I don't regret the associations I made. I mean, I regret spending much longer than I should have. But, you know, it is what it is. That's my story. But I do love that it taught a thoughtful work ethic. It taught the importance of community and connection and structure and liminality. And it taught me to shadow box with a moral world, and it sharpened the edges. So there are things that I'm sensitive to as a Mormon woman who's gone through those experiences of socialization in a very orthodox faith, which, you know, alarm bells will ring. You know, and I'm more broadly involved in the Christian community here in New Zealand with it professionally, but also through my involvement with, you know, theology schools and a movement of, you know, kind of Māori theologians and my time with the Anglican Church. And there are things that as a Mormon, former Mormon, I notice that are small pathologies, which I'm really sensitive to. And I think that's a gift. That's a gift to the church. I hope so. They probably don't say that. Like, they're probably listening and going, no, it's just an irritation, Gina.
No, I think it is good. And especially where we want, you know, what we would call mission or ministry to happen in the context of the people, the past experiences, the current realities of everyone coming together and not only worshiping God, but figuring out what God is, who God is, figuring out how to pray, figuring out how to be in community that upholds the worth of all people. I mean, that takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of voice and a lot of intention and a lot of thoughtfulness, like you've said. So I definitely think, you know, as much as I would want to rid myself of all my Mormon baggage, like, it's impossible. I carry it with me wherever I go and it's always going to be there. But I really am super jazzed when I see former Mormon women just absolutely rocking it. It feels like the ultimate, you know, sorry, Brigham. And like, we're going to move forward. Yeah. Oh, it's great. It's great. So let's talk about your ordination a little bit. Because again, I'm intrigued with this idea that you are really starting something new in New Zealand. You are starting the conversation of what does it look like to be Community of Christ, even if that's Gina Colvin, what does it look like to be Community of Christ in New Zealand? And, you know, because of the pandemic, travel was clearly restricted. And so your ordination happened under unique circumstances. So just tell us a little bit about that, logistically, what it was like. And then as you transitioned again from being a Mormon woman to a leader, a foundational leader in Community of Christ, how was that process for you?
Yeah, it was actually a very gentle process. I'm not one for, it might sound disingenuous, but I'm not one for big things. Like, I hate Christmas. I hate Easter. So I just sort of had a gentle run up to it. I was asked to consider ordination and, you know, immediately said, absolutely. there's no question. And so my ordination, and I'm just trying to think when it happened. the COVID thing has like turned all my timetables inside out.
I was trying to think of when it happened too, and I could not remember.
No, I can't either. I feel like it's been within the last year.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say that. Okay. So, or maybe it happened at the beginning of this year. Anyway, and it was done remotely. And Mareva ordained me. So, and people came in to support that from all over the Pacific and United States. And it was just, I thought it would be weird, but it wasn't. It was moving, it was profound, and it was well thought through and well organized. It was just a really lovely experience. And it's just an odd thing to think that I now have the Melchizedek priesthood. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, and I know that you were involved with ordained women in the LDS Church and clearly in all these conversations about a more equitable way to do church. And then to have your ordination happen online. So like, not only are you doing something that is an outward symbol of equality in a church setting, but then to be able to do it online and have people locally and literally all over the world join in. I doubt you thought that was going to be your future, I guess.
I didn't really. And what was really beautiful and what capped it off beautifully is we have a group, an ecumenical monthly service, a group we call Hei Kōpua, which in Māori means, in English means deep waters. And so we have Baptists and we have a Presbyterian minister. We hold it at Knox Presbyterian Church just down the road. And it's a group of, I guess, kind of marginal, you know, people who want a more innovative spiritual experience, LGBT people who haven't found healing in their formal Christian traditions. And so I offered communion that night to all of these people who were not community of Christ with the absolute blessing of the Presbyterian minister there. So it was just really, really joyful to be able to do that. And I did it in Māori. And my husband, who's Mormon, was very, very tearful. He came and received communion, and it was just, and I looked up and he had tears flowing down his eye, you know, down his cheeks. And it's just a really beautiful experience. And I was so glad to have been able to celebrate the opportunity to offer communion with people from all over the religious spectrum.
Yeah. And I think that you are pointing to something that is so beautiful about Community of Christ, in that you can immediately be ecumenical without fear of any sort of repercussions. You are trusted, your ministry, the spaces that you enter, you are trusted as a representative of the church to be able to provide ministry, which is just brilliant and beautiful. And I'm so glad that your husband was able to be there and that he cried.
That's yes. It was so lovely. And there was that thought, right? Like, am I allowed to do this? And I did have, it was interesting when you talk about that ordination. I thought at any time somebody's going to message me to say, we're not going to go ahead with this because we've seen what you've posted on Facebook. I really thought that I'd get like, and this is something I think, you know, maybe mission center presidents and apostles need to understand. If you write a message to a former Mormon and say, can I have a conversation with you? Alarm bells are going to go.
Yeah, that's scary.
And I'm like, oh no, what have I done? What have I done? But you know, there were all conversations about like, what music would you like? And we're just thinking, you know, who would you like to offer the prayer? So, but you know, I felt I needed to get permission to do this. And people were like, yeah, of course. and I've only felt absolute support from my community, who have been so lovely and so gracious and open and supple and trusting that the Spirit is calling me to do something, and they're really affirming of that. And what a gift.
No, absolutely. It's it's such an affirmation to who you are and to what your surrounding culture needs. And again, I think it goes back to that colonialization of Christianity, of having this hierarchy to say, no, Gina, you do it this way. But the fact that you are trusted and are able to do what you need to do in the context and the space that you are entering is just really, really beautiful. So thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. So you brought up Facebook, so let's go there. I know that you have a spiritual formation group that's specifically about spiritual reconstruction and formation. And I am curious because there are so many former Mormons or even folks who are trying to stay in the Mormon church who are just so spiritually hungry. And it's my understanding that this Facebook group are filled with listeners to your podcast and who are looking for something more, who are looking for something, like you said, more innovative, more inclusive, more flexible, that kind of thing. So talk me through that Facebook group and just some of the posts that you do and maybe the intention behind it of how you are creating community on the internet.
I think it arose because there was a bit of a purge on the Thoughtful Faith support group. And, you know, there was a bit of drama and people who had really depended on that space were being turfed out. And so I quickly set up a page, but I didn't want it to be endless exit stories. There are a lot of places where you can vent about the church, but I suppose the intention was always like, okay, so what now? What do you need? You've obviously let something go. How can we help you let the rest go and make space for something more? And I think that's a really hard movement for a lot of Mormons to make. My sense is there's a lot of deconstruction going on, but people get caught in deconstruction and don't move into reconstruction because it's frightening to consider oneself differently. Composed, made of different elements. So even though those elements are no longer useful and we're warring with them, I think many people are quite highly attached. And that's not a criticism, it's understandable that we're attached to the familiar. If we have to love it or hate it, we'll still stay with it, with the familiar. I mean, I think that's the nature of humanity. And so this space is just a kind of a gentle space to say, actually, there's something more. There are other thoughts to think about. There's other ways of understanding the word God. I mean, Mormons think they have a monopoly on the idea of God. And they have, you know, and when they come into a crisis, the God crisis, the automatic assumption is that everybody has thought this way. It's a funny, I don't know if you've noticed it, but like Mormons will say only us until there's a crisis and it's, now it's everybody. Mm-hmm. So that movement and towards just healthfully letting go of what's not working and allowing what is working to rise up. And I think that's an internal thing. It's not like you have to go out and search for something. And I want to say that I didn't search for community of Christ because I needed the structure anymore. I don't need the structure. I'm okay without the institution, but it was just a really purposeful place and it fit me. It fit my soul. And a supportive place for me to do my own inner work and for that inner work to be part of a community. I was all over the place when I said that. But this is to say that, you know, Mormonism is highly structured. There needs to be a deconstruction. There always must be a deconstruction. It goes with our natural course of development, adults' development, our brains change, the way we understand the world naturally changes. And the church doesn't, the LDS church often doesn't go with that change. It doesn't move intuitively with adult stages of adult development. And so that support group is to say, look, we can journey with you. And as a community, we're going to try and journey with you as you wake up to new realities or you engage with new ways of thinking about the world and your spiritual self. I mean, as you put yourself together again.
And your posts in that group are very inviting, and you introduce people to different theologians, different ways to view scripture, different spiritual practices, different ways to view God, which I think is so important because you articulated something in a way that I had not heard before, but it's absolutely true. This idea that Mormons think that their way of viewing God is so unique that it's only us that believes this and this and this, and we're so, you know, a chosen people, peculiar people, whatever they want to say. But then when they let that go, they assume, or they, you know, even say, well, everybody else thinks that too. I had never thought about that. And it's so true though. And it is like, it's kind of comical because like we, as a people, like I, as a kid, just had this elitism about me, right? That I just thought that I was so much more enlightened than everyone around me. And then when I was going through my faith crisis and transition, I did kind of think like, well, all Christians, all, you know, and it's like, well, maybe there's a different way to look at this. And that's why, I mean, I love, you know, liberation theology or womanist theology and theology that's done from the margins, because the way that they view God or any theological topic like Jesus or atonement or any of these big words that we think only have one way to view, they see them very, very differently. And so, yeah, I've appreciated being in your group and seeing the wide variety of conversations that can have, and then folks who realize like, oh, there's more than one way to look at atonement theology. And it's like, well, yes, there is.
That's been a surprisingly big conversation, atonement theology.
Yeah. People are totally just blindsided that there's a different way to look at this God that doesn't have to be this punitive God that sent his son to die for the sins of the world. And it's like, well, yeah, no, like there's other ways to look at this, friends.
I was doing a public theology class when I was doing my master's. And somebody brought up atonement theology. I'm like, what? Everybody was engaged in this conversation, sort of chuckling about how, you know, kind of penal substitution theologies and atonement theologies are kind of a little bit yesterday. And, you know, haven't we all moved on? And I'm like, whoa, calm the farm, people. Tell me what the heck you're talking about. They're like, oh, yeah. No, we kind of, you know, we've done with penal substitution theology. And I'm like, wow.
Let's continue this conversation.
Yeah, people were chuckling about it like it was so yesterday.
You're like,
my whole religious foundation was on Jesus died for my sins.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing about a faith transition is I feel like I'm still running into, you know, old theological Brittany all the time. That's like, well, shoot, I probably should have deconstructed that by now. You know, it's like, I'm just going to sit here quietly and pretend that I know what it's talking about.
Yeah. I think that, you know, it's a universal Christian experience. I mean, we do think we're unique in our deconstruction, but all Christians, I mean, everybody, well, not everybody, but, you know, you'll get your mainstay of people who will just plod along with the same ideas that they've always had. But for the most part, the Christian conversation is really theologically robust and variety and exciting. I mean, I've been invited by Victoria University to be a panelist on a plenary discussion about spirituality in New Zealand. And I thought, well, and I think the intention was to talk about Christianity, but I'm a Māori Christian woman who's going to be talking about how an assertion of female Māori woman spirituality is to receive the chin tattoo, which we call the moko kauai. And I'm involved in somebody receiving that at the end of November, and have been involved with women who have received this thing in an ancient ritual, and how spiritually transformative this is. It changes their identity. It's like receiving a gift from their ancestresses, and suddenly they become, they're rebirthed. It's like a baptism, and all of the feminine ancestral energy. To be able to be invited to talk about that as a Christian woman, as an important charism, an important passage of spiritual awakening for Māori women, is a real joy. So that's the bigness of the conversation, that sort of thing can be included.
Which, again, to contrast that from what you came from, is a completely Americanized, whitewashed, we're going to make everybody dress in suits and ties. And recognizing, so when you're going through your faith transition, you know, you, general you, that you don't have to have what you had before or nothing, that there is an entire world open, that the feminine divine doesn't have to be a polygamist wife to Heavenly Father, right?
Right. It doesn't have to be Heavenly Mother.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. But you can have this rich, culturally informed, beautiful ceremony that connects women to generations past, and to have it not be controlled by a patriarchal system that is out to shame people because Jesus had to die because they sinned, right? Like, right. There's other ways to look at this, is all I'm saying.
Exactly. And it's such a beautiful world to be in, it to be part of the conversation is so brilliant and so fulfilling and so joyous. And I will say that the kind of conversation of Mormonism just gets boring. Mm. You know, I mean, it's intriguing, but the more fully I become part of this conversation and involved in a Christianity that's diverse and it's non-literal and it's sometimes syncretic, it's contextualizing, it's inclusive, the less important the go round in circles, the spinning in circles of the Mormon conversation is, because there is no theological room there. Mm. People talk about Mormon theology. Well, I'd like to see it. Thank you. What you have is Mormon doctrine. Yeah. It's me getting on my high horse. You have no right to talk about Mormon theology until you have a dedicated program of theology, Mormon theology, students and staff actually being permitted to contest the boundaries of the question of God. What you're doing is you're shuffling doctrinal decks, a deck of doctrinal cards, and trying to make it work. But very few Mormons are involved in the theological discussion.
Well, and I think that you raise a really good point, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but this is probably why joining a church that's not necessarily well established in your country was not that big of a deal, because you weren't necessarily signing on to a set of doctrines, a set of procedure, a set of policies and hierarchy that is so structured. Like, Community of Christ, in contrast to that, is more of a movement. Yes, there's hierarchy, there's policies. It is a church, but there's an aspect of it that is, the undercurrent of it is a spiritual movement, right? It's community of Christ. And where we can do so many things online, those geographical boundaries that once separated us, that, you know, made it harder to communicate with one another, that's not there anymore. And so you're really able to join the conversation with your larger mission center and beyond, mm-hmm. And provide ministry literally all over the world. I think of what you've done with Maxine Hanks, you know, during the pandemic and those worship services that you've helped facilitate. And so your ministry, literally has no borders, and the conversations that you are liberated to have no borders either. Mm-hmm. And there's something just really beautiful about that. And it makes church, and I'm air quoting right now, as like a secondary compared to a spiritual movement of seekers who are trying to reframe God and ritual and sacrament and theology. So it's really beautiful.
Yeah, and I did consider, I was part of the Anglican Church for a few years, had dual citizenship as a Mormon and then an Anglican, but mostly was involved with our local Anglican parish, which I will say my children are still involved in our local Anglican parish, and probably Nathan is involved as a youth leader much more than I am. I'm a bit busy. It's sort of a weird thing. But anyway, and I did consider that. I consulted with my friends, my group of Maori women friends, and I said, right, I'm thinking of joining another church. What should it be? And they said, oh, Anglican. You have to join the Anglican church. And I said, why? And they said, well, because first of all, your family are Anglican, your, you know, Māori family who were Mormon and were previously Anglican generations ago. And then it was because of their social justice emphasis. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I gave it a shot, and I'm still part of that community. But I think it became very clear to me that the suppleness that I need, the suppleness, the openness to discussion, less structure. I need less structure, and the kind of boundaries of the church. Like, there's nothing to hold down structurally, institutionally, as a member of Community of Christ in New Zealand. So there's a whole history. There are egos to hold down. There are liturgies to hold down, and fights over the silliest things that I really can't be bothered with. You know, I'm sort of at the other half of my life, and I really can't be bothered being sort of worrying about whether or not a certain place in the liturgy for something is going to upset the parishioners.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. And you have the flexibility to still be involved, but not like the space to not get involved in the drama of it.
Yeah, churches are full of drama. I mean, that is one thing people are right. It's dramatic, you know, for many people. I mean, in Community of Christ, it can be, nobody's immune. They can be very fraught contexts. You have a sense of humor about it because, and it's not quite so precious that we think this is the end of the world, because it happens everywhere. That's just what happens when people get together, and they just, in an intimate way in which church brings you together.
Yeah. And it is humorous sometimes when you said fights over the stupidest things. It's like, yeah, I've been involved with some of those.
Yeah. That's just the way it is. Yeah.
So kind of combining everything that we've talked about, as you think about the future of church or Christianity, what direction do you hope that it goes in? What do you think that spiritual seekers are looking for, and how do you want to create that community?
I think that I really think we're at a time where Christianity has to wake up to itself. We have so many pathologies that we've inherited over the centuries, and it's becoming untenable. It's almost blowing itself up. It's self-destructing before our eyes, and I'm not sad about that. I'm not holding on to the way things have always been. And, you know, I'm a bit of a fan of Peter Rollins, who talks about pyrotheology, which is like, burn it all down and let's see what comes up out of the ashes. Mark Barnard is a really important Anglican priest here in New Zealand, and he was, you know, I work in youth development, and he was talking to our students about the treaty, which is a treaty between Māori and the colonial government in 1840, and it's a really important part of our culture to understand what happened historically. And some young man asked him during this conversation, well, the church has been responsible, your church has been responsible for some of the atrocities that's happened. So can you please answer the question? What culpability does the church have for setting up colonial institutions and incorporating Indigenous peoples into a regime of colonization? And he was really thoughtful about that. But he said, you know what, Christianity at its best is Christianity at the margins. It's Christianity small. It's Christianity local. It's at around the table. The worst thing that has happened to Christianity is its co-option into empire, into economic empire and political empire. And, you know, in the American context, into a business empire. And I agree with that. I think that the more that Christianity confronts its own sins, the smaller it becomes. And I don't mean it diminishes, but it becomes smaller in its ambitions. smaller in its desire to attach to something larger than itself, if it works at the margins in ways of that replicate, I suppose. And here's the thing that I love. It's the image of Christ on the cross, which is a symbol of Christianity at its best. And not because Jesus is dying for our sins. That was the bait and switch. That's the wrong hermeneutic to bring that to. But Christianity says, I will die. I will let myself go because of the greater principle of human compassion. That's how far I will go for another person. That would be the limit of my compassion is death of the self. So I think Christianity calls us into constantly dying to our former selves, but also giving ourselves to community. And I don't think Christians do that. Anybody does that better than the Christian community.
Gina, that was so beautiful. I think that it's so easy to get distracted by the bells and whistles of church and the policy and the boundaries and borders that humans, specifically men, historically have created around Christianity and the way that they have superimposed it on different cultures in a way that divorces it from its original context, right? It was not a white religion. And recognizing that at the core of Christian values is the death of oneself, the giving up of oneself, meeting people in the margins without shame, without punishment, that it is walking with people where they are at and creating community from that in a way that makes sense in that context. So the way that you described that was really beautiful and just such an imaginative way to rethink all of this that we've been doing for centuries. And I really appreciate that. It's beautiful.
Yeah. One of the things I do that we have house church at home, we have home church and it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous to have my family around, to have communion together, to have a time of spiritual insight and thought.
Yeah.
And my boys love it. They love it so much more than going to church, which is quite institutionalized. And I think that's the way that Christian faith is best, is best seen and best expressed.
Exactly. And the fact that they can see their mom leading that is so beautiful. Like it just melts my heart.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. I think if you asked my kids, they'd say that I was Buddhist, so...
I've kind of wondered about that. Like, what do your kids, I mean, and you don't have to go deep into their stories, but spiritually, where are they and how do they see your journey? Like, if I were to sit down with them, what would they say about you?
I don't know. It could be frightening. I think they would say the Mormons excommunicated mum. But we like say, no, they didn't. Oh. And then, you know, a couple of months later, she was excommunicated. I wasn't actually excommunicated. I mean, but I think they were responding to the violence done to me. And they saw how kind of sad and fraught our whole family was over this. And I do remember, I've said this before, but I was baptized by my Anglican priest. And my baptism wasn't into the Anglican church as much. It was as into the body of Christ. I really felt that draw into, I want to be in the body of Christ. I don't want to be baptized into a church, just in the body of Christ. And so it was an interesting time. And we still get teary about this, Megan and I, my priest. I just felt one evening, it was a Thursday night, and I just felt I would like to be baptized. We'd talked about it a bit. Nothing had been set down. And I went to her, to the vicarage, to drop the kids off for youth group. And I said, what are you guys doing? She said, we're going to the beach. And I said to her, and it just came out of my mouth before I said, well, there'll be a great time for you to baptize me then. She said, well, I thought you'd say that because I have everything packed in the car. So there goes your spiritual experience, Mormons.
Brilliant.
And so we went out to the beach. My kids were all there watching. The full moon came out, you know, which is a huge symbol of the feminine. And under this full moon, I was baptized by, with the help of, you know, two women. And I came out of the water and one of my sons, Xander, said, "Wow, you're going to be excommunicated now." Megan said, "Shut up, Xander."
Way to kill the mood.
Right. But, I mean, I think that's them saying that I was taking a risk of faith.
Yeah, yeah.
And they saw that journey. And Xander's our rainbow boy. So for him, I think he feels that I made decisions of faith that I would only be in a community that would be affirming of LGBT people. And that meant loss, and that meant seeking, and that meant, you know, gaining something else. So I think for him, he really appreciates that I'm not holding anything down spiritually or religiously that would marginalize him and his sexuality. My boys have different needs, spiritual needs. Once I asked them, "Who do you think God is?" One said, "God's a heavenly father," which is so typical of him. I mean, he's at an evangelical Christian school. He needs things structured and clear. One said, "God's transgender." Another one said, "God's a woman." You know, we had all of this stuff over the spectrum, and I think that's what we're dealing with when we open the conversation to our children. And when we think about their worship life, their faith life, we have to, as parents, be equipped to hold that. Whatever gorgeous expression of the divine and spirituality that's coming up for them, know enough about, be spiritually formed well enough so that you can really gently hold each of their developing expressions.
Well, and what a beautiful gift that is. Not every kid has that, right? Especially kids whose parents are spiritual or religious or have some sort of set of beliefs. It's so easy for parents to want to impose their beliefs on others, and, you know, particularly their children. And so for you to be able to hold that space, even if it's a different image of God than you have, that's a gift to give to your boys, and a way to empower them to trust their own inner voice, and that they can connect with the divine in a way that makes sense for them, and that it doesn't need to make sense to you, even if, you know, one doesn't even claim that it's God, you know, again, using air quotes. That's such a beautiful gift, and it's a scary gift. Like, as a parent, I want to acknowledge that it can be kind of scary. Maybe I'm just a control freak, but allowing kids to have their own spiritual path and just being okay to hold that and to hold that space is really beautiful. So
yeah, and I think the only thing that we really truly have that's our own is our spiritual life, and I think we're called to be creators of that spiritual life. It's the only thing that's truly open and free in us. And so be the artist, and provide the materials for your children, and, you know, allow yourself to journey into this, because it doesn't demand anything from you. There's no payment. It's not a course, you know. To understand your spiritual gifts and to understand your connection, your spiritual connection with all things, is the greatest journey to go on, I think. And that's the best thing, I think, that we can give our children, because it makes their life meaningful.
Amen. You're so good with, like, little one-liner nuggets that are just have been really meaningful for me. So thank you.
Oh, yes.
So I really only have one more question, and it's, So I work in Utah, obviously, with a lot of what we call Latter-day Seekers, folks who are interested in Community of Christ from the Mormon Church. And sometimes there is hesitancy So there's interest, but then there's also hesitancy. They're intrigued by who Community of Christ is, but they can't get over Joseph Smith baggage, or they can't get over the fact that there's not a church on every corner, like here in Utah and the Mormon Church. So Gina, I know that you've spoken before a little bit about this general topic of folks who are interested in Community of Christ, but who just have hesitancies and just get held back by Joseph Smith. So could you maybe verbalize some of that for us on the podcast? I think it's really, again, interesting that you took the steps to join an institution that, again, ties back to Joseph Smith and that doesn't have a church on every corner. So it's not like a convenient church to join, right? It's not, it's not something that doesn't come with a lot of baggage and heartbreak and just things that you have to work through. So I guess what I'm asking is to have you speak directly to folks who on their own accord are interested, but who still feel held back by the Mormon baggage that they carry.
I mean, that's such an interesting question, and I encountered it recently. I was invited to co-author a chapter on the apostasy and restoration with a professor from BYU, and I was wildly triggered by the whole experience. And, you know, he was very gracious. I was very forthright and said, I've discovered the question of apostasy. As somebody who's been charged with apostasy, I'm so angry at the church. And he was very gracious and said, look, I understand why. And poor old Andrew Bolton had to deal with me sort of flipping out occasionally and wondering whether or not he's going to get my part of the chapter. But, you know, we got there. But I think the point was that I finally got to is that we have been talking about, and this is just my opinion, but actually having written this chapter, it occurred to me as I was finalizing the final paragraph, we're not actually part of the LDS restoration. We're not restorationist. We're post-restorationist. We're post-restoration progressive kind of ecumenical Christians with an enormous future because we're really happy to deal with our past. I think we are LDS restoration by history, by historical implication, but the revolution or the renaissance of the 1960s and onwards has meant that more than any other faith tradition that I've ever encountered, there is a quality and a depth to the theological work and positioning that we as a movement have that I haven't seen replicated anywhere else. It's unique, you know, and to get to this point, I went through a reasonably progressive Baptist church. I've done Quakers, which I still quite like because they don't say anything. And I've done Anglican. I hang around with Ignatian Catholics. I retreat with them. So, you know, and I attend the local Zen Buddhist Zendo. So I haven't had my head in a cloud. But when it comes to Community of Christ, I feel like it's done enough of its work. And it's lived the question of not necessarily restoration, but reformation in a serious and thoughtful and spiritually informed way, which means that we have things like the enduring principles, which are foundational. It's not like the Nicene Creed, which I couldn't get down with, you know, as an Anglican, we have to say it every week. Okay, it's fine, but I do much prefer the enduring principles. But so I would say to you that, look, no church is perfect, but if you want a community which isn't going to define you, which isn't going to be, you're not going to be hung up by historical issues. This is a forward-facing, post-restoration, progressive reforming movement in which your spiritual giftedness, regardless of your sexuality or regardless of your gender, regardless of your skin color, is welcome. And that is, and it surprises me because on its own merits, there's a brilliance to community of Christ. When I speak about community of Christ to people in my own community, they're like, oh, wow, that sounds really interesting. If you speak to people who know people from community of Christ, they say, yep, community of Christ, that's solid. Doesn't have much money, but but I mean, that's a good thing, I think, in many respects. People kind of like are quite woeful about our lack of, by comparison, wealth, but I think it's brilliant. I think it's wonderful. I think it's all churches need to experience who they are without the trappings of finances. So anyway, that's my little spiel. Like, it's spiritually mature. And spiritual maturity is something that I don't think you'll find elsewhere. If you're troubled with being Christian, go to the UUs, go to the UUs. But if you are really still intrigued by a beautiful and mature and well-developed Christian expression of spirituality, then I just think look no further than Community of Christ. Like, I mean, you won't show up in Craig's Drive, wherever it is in Salt Lake City, and go, oh, wow, I've come to Zion. At a community level, it's, you know, every community has its issues. I haven't found there to be the knots and the briars that I have found in other places. So, yeah.
Thank you for that perspective. I think that it can be so hard for ex-Mormons or just unchurched folks in general, people who have been abused or thrown away from religion, to understand that there could be a community of people that want to do spirituality in a healthy way. And somehow Community of Christ has been able to do that. And the fact that you said that we're a post-restoration movement, I mean, I would agree. We're not waiting for Jesus to return to restore some big millennial surprise. We're not trying to get at this institution, and again, air quotes, that Jesus set up. This idea that there's an apostasy automatically makes us into this elitist corporate understanding of God. No, we think and believe in our core heart that God has been with humanity this whole time, and getting back to that simple truth. And like you said, not being weighed down by finances and all the things that make church a church has been really beautiful. And it can be difficult for ex-Mormons, I think, to understand that that's where we're at. But I've seen really awesome transformations when people get it. So thank you. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And get this, we're not trying to be Mormon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're not a jazzy version of the Utah, the Mountain Saints. Like, Community of Christ is utterly its own thing and should be considered on its own merits. And I'm always mindful, you had a conversation with Rachel Held Evans, in an airport, who mentioned Community of Christ. It stands out on its own merits. Yes, it has those connections, but those are incidental. At this point in our church's history, those connections to Joseph Smith, and if you talk to the descendants of Joseph Smith, they're as sort of ho-hum about that whole restoration story. That restoration story that has been mythologized belongs to the Mountain Saints. It was our history at one stage that has now been deconstructed. You don't need to be confronted by it.
Exactly. Ah, Gina, again, you're just so full of good, good thoughts and one-liners. Thank you. So is there anything else? I always like to just leave it open if there's anything else that I didn't ask that you would like to say before we wrap this up.
I don't have anything else. I mean, I suppose I'd just like to bless everybody's journey and to say that you were called to spiritual creation, and don't be stuck and wallowing in something that no longer fits, trying to squeeze into something that no longer fits. The universe is calling you out to a full expression of your spiritual self. And, you know, whether Community of Christ is part of that journey or not is beside the point. You know, you're free. I free you. God frees you. That's not to say I'm God, but...
Oh, Gina, this has been such a joy. Thank you so much. And again, for our listeners, Gina is the host of the Thoughtful Faith podcast. I almost said contest. And
it would be a cool thing, wouldn't it? Who can be the most thoughtfully faithful?
And you can also find her on Facebook. So, Gina, thank you so much. And I'm sure we'll have you on again.
Oh, blessings. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.